Okay, I think we can start. A couple of announcements. First, I have to change my office hours because I have an off-campus appointment on Monday. There'll be 2:30 to 3:30, and I'll try to have the next homework set posted Friday or Saturday. They'll probably be due in a week, but I haven't 100% decided yet. So last time we derived the differential equations of magnetostatics. I guess I should turn off the projector. And they say that the curl of B, the magnetic induction, is mu naught times J, and del dot B is zero. And we're going to pursue these equations today with hunger and excitement and enthusiasm. But first, I have a little aside about Earnshaw's theorem. Earnshaw was a British reverend, also a mathematician, and in 1842, he used his math skills to prove this theorem that since in if you have a static situation of charges or currents, you can't have a stable configuration. You can't arrange charges in any way or currents in any way that if you then let them go, they will stay in that. It's always unstable in at least one direction. And you can understand that basically because del squared phi is zero in charge-free space and also in current-free space. And that means, right, if you have curvature that's attractive in one direction, it has to be repulsive in some other direction. Like that's what a saddle looks like. And that applies in both electrostatics, that's where he proved it, but also in magnetostatics. So today I'm going to give you a demonstration of this theorem. So I have a little magnetic dipole, and it is repelled by the magnet in this base. If I let it go, it just drops, right? But if I get it moving, angular momentum conservation can keep this magnetic dipole from flipping over, and there is a very shallow potential well that you can kind of think of that depends on the velocity that it is rotating at. It has to be rotating between about 16 and 21 revolutions per second in order for it to be stable and not for these maxima not to be lower than the minimum. So I will see if I can achieve this stability in this local minimum. It's not always easy to make it happen. And there we have levitation in that shallow minimum. As it gradually slows down by collisions with the air molecules, it will eventually, local maxima will disappear and it will collapse. It's really there, no wires, no strings. Magnetic fields go right through everything. That's why MRIs are such a beautiful technology. They just do nothing to living tissue or almost all matter. So anyway, it will do this for maybe a few minutes at most, and then it will slow down and become unstable. Anyway, I thought that was really cool. The first time I saw this demonstrated was by, I think, it was Michael Berry, who is actually Sir Michael Berry in England, and a famous mathematical physicist. And I think he might be co-inventor of this device, which is called the Levitron. Actually, this one is the super Levitron, which you can buy probably for about $70 on the internet somewhere. Anyway, I like it. I bought it for my daughter when she was about six, but I really got more enjoyment out of it than she did. Okay, I'll just let that levitate a little longer until it decides to give up. So that's Earnshaw's theorem. And you only because of the virtue of this spinning, the rotation and angular momentum conservation, is it have this region of stability that would seem otherwise to violate Earnshaw's theorem. Okay, well, it's wobbling. Okay, we'll just let it drop when it wants to. Okay, so one of the things we proved last time was Ampere's law. And it occurred to me that in the notes, I didn't have notes on any applications of Ampere's law. You all did this as undergraduates, but I thought I would do the standard derivation you do with Ampere's law. You can only apply this kind of like Gauss's law if you have a very high amount of symmetry. But the straight wire problem of finite thickness, of infinite length, is such a problem. And if you have a current I that's spread uniformly across this surface of radius A, let's say, then we know the magnetic field is going to curl around this in the phi hat direction, if we say that's the z direction. And so the kind of simple application of Ampere's law would say, maybe if I do a look on a cross section of the wire looking head on, right, and the magnetic field is going to curl around it, this is radius A, then if you want to find the magnetic induction inside the wire with the current flowing out of the board, you would draw a loop at the distance R, or maybe I should call it rho, where you want the field, the magnetic induction, and then you would apply Ampere's law, right, which says that the integral of B dot dA is mu naught times the enclosed current. And in this case, don't forget you have to be careful about the direction of dA. You want this. If this is my z-axis in this direction of the current, you want it curling around in the right-hand rule sense. But then, sorry, I messed this up already. This is b dot dl, right, is the integral of j dot dA. And it's a closed-loop integral. Right, so this left-hand side, in this case, would be 2 pi rho b, if b is in this phi hat direction. And the mu naught in the current enclosed would be the ratio of the area inside my Amperian loop to the total area, right? So that would be I times pi rho squared over pi a squared. And so you can solve for the magnitude of B would be mu naught over 2 pi I times rho. And I can add my unit vectors to give it the direction. So this would be the magnetic field or magnetic induction inside the wire. And the derivation goes similarly. If I want it at some distance rho outside, the only difference is the total current now is going through this Amperian loop. And so we would get that B would be mu naught over 2 pi rho I forgot an A squared here in this first in the inside, and this would be outside. So anyway, that's make sure you know how to do these elementary types of problems that can be solved by Ampere's law that you probably learned as undergraduates. Okay, but now we'll start doing the fancier types of problems that our Jackson is famous for. Just in the general category of trying to solve these differential laws of magnetostatics. So the first example is about regions of magnetic field where there are no sources. Okay, so basically, if J is not existing in some region, then throughout that region, the curl of B is zero. And because the curl of B is zero, that means we could write B as the gradient of a scalar potential. It's a different scalar potential than we had in electrostatics, of course. It's not an electric potential, but it's a magnetic scalar potential. And so because del dot B is zero, always, there are no known magnetic monopoles in the universe, which is what this is saying, that this is always, 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 always zero until someone finds a magnetic dipole. Blas Cabrera thought he had found one and got a Physical Review letter once when he thought he found one. Nobody found one since, and I believe it's now believed that that was an artifact in about 1976. Okay, so because del dot B is zero, we have one of our favorite equations. Del squared phi is zero. You guys know how to solve that now. We've spent a large fraction of the semester already solving Laplace's equation when the Laplacian is zero. Okay. The only difference is that the boundary conditions, of course, are different from those in electrostatic. But still, the basic tools, separation of variables in one of the, I think, 11 coordinate systems where you can separate variables in Laplace's equation and then maybe make infinite series or Green's functions, all that fun and games. Okay, so anyway, that's one class of problems you should keep in mind. Especially when you don't have current, or you have currents only outside some region, you can use Laplace's equation to solve for the magnetic scalar potential using the toolkit you know already. Of course, when we have magnetic fields, very often we would like to solve problems that involve currents. And we can't say then that there is a magnetic scalar potential. So that brings us to case number two, which is a more general treatment. It doesn't rely on del cross B being zero, but it's a more general treatment that relies only on the thing I said that's always, always true. It's based on just del dot B is zero. Since del dot B is zero, we can always say that B is the curl of a potential, a vector potential. So that's for some vector field A of X. In electrostatics, of course, it has no time dependence. We'll call that the vector potential, this vector field A of X. So in fact, in the derivation we did last time, we got a formula for B, namely the curl of this integral, mu naught over 4 pi, the integral over the current density at x prime, d cubed x prime over distance between a source current at d cubed x prime and an observation point at x. And so this leads us to conclude that we could write a formula for A, that the vector potential at any point in space x is equal to mu naught over 4 pi, that integral j of x prime d cubed x prime over the distance between source and observation points. Possibly A might have the gradient of some other function because its curl would not contribute to B. This would lead to the same B field. But for now, we will set this term to zero and revisit that point in chapter 6. But in principle, just based on our derivation, this could be an arbitrary psi of x, could be added. And it's good to keep that in mind. So one thing that's interesting about the vector potential is, I mean, one thing that's kind of hard about magnetic fields is they're always curling around sources, right? You have a source current, and that's not at all the direction of the magnetic field. It's not in the direction of the current, just like electric fields are in the direction of the vector from the source charge. But the vector potential is simpler because it's sort of in the direction of the current. And that kind of is easier to visualize. So just sort of generally, qualitatively speaking. And so the twists of in the magnetic field are basically coming from the curl operation. That's where we get the curling, twisting behavior of the magnetic field lines. Okay, so let's apply this to one kind of basic, simple, straightforward geometry of a circular current loop. So we'll compute A and B eventually for a circular current loop of radius A. And so we'll have some diagram here. Have an XYZ axis, we'll have a circular loop, we'll put in the XY plane. And one thing, well, let me write the integral first of all. So A of X is this integral I wrote over there, mu naught over 4 pi integral j d cubed x prime, j at x prime over the magnitude. But one thing to know is in a lot of problems you have a wire loop which doesn't really look like a j, right? It's kind of infinitely thin wire you're having in mind. And then this alternative form of the formula for A is more directly applicable. You can write it as mu naught I times this loop integral of dl prime over the distance from an infinitesimal length of the loop, of the wire loop. So j d cubed x prime is I dl prime. Make sure you understand that. And in effect, if you want to see how that is derived, you could write j in a couple of different ways. J of x prime, I could write for this problem as phi hat times current times sine theta prime delta of cos theta prime delta of r prime minus a over a. So that is, let's see, one expression. I think I might not need this. I forget. Let me put that in parentheses. Anyway, theta prime in our example is pi over 2, so it probably won't matter. But another expression that's maybe more straightforward and easy to visualize would be phi hat I in cylindrical coordinates, delta of z prime, delta of rho prime minus a. So one thing that's of course, you want to ensure is that the integral of j d cubed x prime by itself over a differential cross-sectional area that contains current coming out that contains, I'm getting worse at drawing, contains this current, integral over that should come out to be I, integrating over this area orthogonal, differential area orthogonal to the current flow. You need this to come out to be I times the differential length. And if, for instance, the current loop was up here at some angle theta prime, then I think you would need this sine theta prime, and you would want this to work out to be IA sine theta prime d phi prime times phi hat, or phi hat prime. So you might think through how we get from this J representation to I, kind of make sure you kind of understand that relationship. Okay, so let's tackle this integral. And first thing I want to do is simplify the geometry slightly, because we have this circular symmetry about the z-axis. I would be free to pick my x-axis in line with my observation point, which simplifies the algebra, the math a bit. Okay, so let me make a slightly more careful diagram. That means it's at phi equals zero, by the way. All right, so in other words, of our wire loop, and this is our xz plane, says we're going to choose our observation point to lie somewhere in the xz plane. Here's a typical observation point. We've chosen the x-axis to line up with that so that P is in that plane. Then it has an angle, it's characterized by an angle theta from the z-axis, which is, of course, and then we have its projection down onto the x-axis. This is our vector x from the origin, the center of the circle, and x prime to some current loop would be here, and here is a little element dl prime. So for this geometry, the distance between x prime and x inverse can write as r squared cos squared theta plus r sine theta minus a cos phi prime squared plus a squared sine squared phi prime to the minus 1/2. I think I won't go walk you through the trig, but you might try to convince yourself that for this geometry and that picture, that is the quantity in brackets is the square of the distance between dl prime and the observation point x. So there are ways to solve this. We could approach it using the toolkit that we were using in electrostatics. Okay, one way is to just try to do the integral directly, which is actually what I'm going to work on. And but you could also expand in spherical harmonics this 1 over x minus x prime. We know that expansion by heart by now. We also have a cylindrical expansion. I guess it had Bessel functions in it, so that would be fun. I'm not going to do it that way either. Okay, so let's try to do it the direct way, see how far we can go evaluating that integral for the vector potential. So first of all, I will parameterize the current carrying loop. I guess I'm going to assume it's going around in the right-hand rule sense. So basically in the phi hat direction, the current. And so my parameterized path of the wire loop will just depend on this phi prime coordinate. And I can write it as x hat a cos phi prime plus y hat a sine phi prime. And we will need dl prime. Just take the differential minus a x hat sine phi prime d phi prime. Plus a y hat cos phi prime d phi prime. I see in my notes I left off the d phi prime in the cosine term. You might correct that if you've printed them out. But this is in fact simply a phi hat prime d phi prime, right, since phi prime hat is minus x hat sine phi prime plus y hat cos phi prime. Whenever I see an equation like that, I usually try to see, does that make sense? When I'm on the x-axis, phi prime is 0. But the direction of d phi prime, the direction of phi hat prime is this way. That's the direction of increasing phi hat, or phi prime, I mean. That's the direction. And so, in fact, yeah, there's no x component of phi hat prime at this point. It's only in the y direction, and it's exactly in the y hat direction. So I do this kind of thing to make sure the equations sort of match my figure. Okay, so let's write out the integral in all its beauty. A of x, then, is mu naught I a over 4 pi. Integral 0 to 2 pi of d phi prime minus x hat sine phi prime plus y hat cos phi prime. Over this distance, r squared plus a squared minus 2ar sine theta cos phi prime to the 1/2. I could also write this as an integral minus pi to pi if I want. And in that form, it's a little easier to see that the integrand is an odd function of phi prime integrated over a symmetric interval. And so we know the x hat component will vanish just by that observation. Anytime you have an odd integrand integrated over a symmetric interval, then that integral is zero. And again, what's special about the x component of A? Again, the x component is the component along the direction in the plane that contains the observation point. Okay, so we're setting the vector x, remind you, to be x, 0, z. It does not have a y component by virtue of the geometry we set everything up in, which we can write as r sine theta, 0, cos theta in spherical coordinates. And so A of x, can factor out the y hat outside of the integral. We have mu 0 I A over 4 pi. And now the integral 0 to 2 pi, I'll go back to that range of the integral, is cos phi prime d phi prime over r squared plus a squared minus 2ar sine theta cos phi prime to the 1/2. Okay, so this is a fine example of an integral you could spend your life trying to work out, or you could type it into Mathematica. I did the latter. Equal to y hat, which in fact you can see is going to generalize when I now relax the requirement that I only have observation points on the y on the x-axis. It's actually in general going to be in the phi hat direction if I pick a more general x vector. So I'll just make that generalization now. And the integral works out to be mu naught I a squared pi r sine theta over 4 pi times a squared plus r squared to the 3/2. Doesn't look scary at all yet. And then we have a 2f1 hypergeometric function. These are really useful functions. You don't like it? I've had research problems where I was trying to do a hard integral and I was just so happy when I could finally express it as a hypergeometric function. You have no idea. Well, they're a class of functions. They obey a differential equation. They include many of the functions you know, like Legendre, associated Legendre functions are one example of a 2F1. There's another class of hypergeometric called 1F1. Which includes things like Laguerre polynomials, Hermite polynomials, those things you've heard of. Hydrogenic wave functions can be written in terms of the 1F1 hypergeometric function, also called the confluent hypergeometric function. There's a whole infinite amount of literature on these. They're really well known. Oh, if you want to calculate it mathematically, I could give you that because you'll probably want to go home and plot this, right? It would be this command, hypergeometric to capital F1 of A, B, C, Z. Jackson does this integral and writes it, I think, in terms of elliptic integrals. Okay, so. But I didn't try to express it the way Jackson does, and I don't really care. Once I've got one answer, I'm happy. Okay, well, now we have the fun ahead of us of taking the curl of that expression. And you all know you can look up the formula for the curl in spherical coordinates in the back page of Jackson. Okay, so again, A is in the phi direction, as we found, which makes sense since the current is in the phi hat direction. And they tend to be kind of mirroring each other, the vector potential and the current. And that simplifies the taking of the curl because we only have one component of this vector in spherical coordinates. So if you look up the curl, it will have a radial, an r component, and a theta component, right? It won't have any phi hat components. So this will be 1 over r sine theta d by d theta of sine theta a phi will be our radial component of the B field. I guess I did. I've erased my diagram. All right, so there will be a component of B in that direction, will be that calculation, that derivative. And there will be a theta direction component minus 1 over r d by dr of r a phi. So I write the theta component will be in that direction. It's going down from the z-axis along the plane containing the observation point. So the 2F1 is a complicated beast, but it does have some simple properties. When z is 0, these hypergeometric functions, as long as the indices here, I think, are positive or non-zero, when z is 0, these all go to 1. So we can see we could look at evaluate pretty simply the large r limit because this has an r squared over r to the fourth at very large distances. And so let's look at that limit where we don't have to know all the full properties of that hypergeometric function. In fact, I can write its power series. Someone wanted to know what it is. This is an exact statement of what this function is. It's actually very simple to write. 1 plus AB over C times 1 factorial times Z plus A times A plus 1, B times B plus 1 over C times C plus 1 times 2 factorial. Okay, and just now add up the infinite number of terms following that pattern. Simple. That's not a complicated function. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, z squared. None of you guys caught it? Only one in the whole classroom. Oh, you would have seen it. I'm writing it pretty fast. So let's look at the large R behavior first of A, which depends on R and theta. As R goes to infinity, it looks like mu naught I A squared R sine theta over 4 times A squared plus R squared to the 3 halves plus order of R to the minus 5, I think. So let's just approximate that at very large distances where we can neglect the A squared in the denominator as mu naught I A squared sine theta over 4 R squared as R goes to infinity. That's our vector potential of the finite loop at large distances. This is a really important limit. We're often interested in this limit, believe it or not. Think of a nucleus with spin. It has charge, and so a nucleus with spin is a current, and it has a magnetic dipole moment. And at the distances where the electrons are in the atom, that's almost like infinity away compared to the size of the nucleus, of the currents in the nucleus. So that's why one example of a case why we care about the large R limit. So we'll do these derivatives on this large R form, not on the completely general form of A. And then we get that the radial component goes at infinity, infinite distance, to this leading term, mu naught over 2 pi times I pi A squared times cos theta over R cubed. And B theta goes in that limit to mu naught over 2 pi times I pi A squared again, but sine theta over R cubed. And now you may not remember the, yeah.
So was the reason we could write A of phi like this was because the hypergeometric function,
we took the limit where it was 1. Yeah.
And that's because the term V for this one
is going to 0. Yeah, that's exactly the logic. So you may not remember the formulas we had for an E field produced by a magnetic dipole. Sorry, for an electric dipole. I don't think I have that with me. I guess it's in the notes or it's in the book. It has this same structure, this cos theta over R cubed, sine theta over R cubed, when you write it in spherical coordinates and you pick an observation point on the x-axis. So this kind of suggests that we might call for this problem M, the area times the current as the magnetic dipole moment of this current distribution. And so let me write this a little bit more generally, observing that z hat cross the vector x, written as a unit vector, is phi hat sine theta, since we're at the point where phi is zero. How do I get that? Let me just quickly go through that. All right, the vector x can write as x hat r sine theta cos phi plus y hat r sine theta sine phi plus z hat r cos theta. When I take z hat cross this, well, divided by the length of x, which is r, if I take z hat cross this, maybe call it, I don't want to call it x hat, that would be confusing. Then this will only, the z part, of course, will be 0, z hat cross z hat. And I'll get a z hat cross the x hat term will be y hat times the sine theta cos phi. And the z hat cross this term, y hat, will be a minus x hat sine theta sine phi. Right, but that is just phi hat sine theta, which is what I wrote up here. All right, phi hat we saw earlier was y hat cos phi minus x hat sine phi. Okay, so that allows us to put all this in a more general form. It's getting actually pretty simple. At the vector potential at large distances from the current loop, from the magnetic dipole, is mu naught over 4 pi. This magnetic dipole vector m crossed into the observation point vector x divided by the magnitude, the distance x cubed, where this m is pi a squared current times the unit vector at right angles to the current loop in the right-hand rule direction. This formula for m, of course, is only valid for our circular current loop in the xy plane. Later, we'll have a more general way to define this magnetic dipole moment for other geometries. So we have this. Let's look at the curl of it. Still more fun to be had. Curl of A, and I'm not kidding here. I mean it. Curl of A is mu naught over 4 pi times, we have a curl of a constant vector times a vector divided by a scalar. And so we will whip out one of the formulas from the first inside cover of Jackson. And there will be an M times del dot the vector x over distance cubed. And then there will be a term M dot del acting on the vector x over distance cubed. Now, something interesting happens with this first term, del dot the vector x over magnitude cubed. I worked it out in total, brutal, beautiful detail in the lecture notes and show that it's zero. I think I will spare you dragging you through those lines of algebra. Now, you can do that at home in your vast spare time. Go through that argument. And then this other term, M dot del, acting on x over the distance cubed. Right, M is only in the z-axis, so this means M d by dz of x over distance cubed, which will have two pieces. There will be an M z hat over x cubed from differentiating the numerator, and then there will be a minus 3m x times z over length of x to the fifth power from differentiating the denominator, or the inverted denominator. And this whole thing can be rewritten a little simpler as minus 3 m dot x times x all over x to the fifth distance plus m over the distance cubed. But this has even a still simpler expression. If I define n hat as the unit vector pointing in the direction x, okay, pointing to the observation point, then I can write this result in this form as B as the curl of A for a magnetic dipole far away from the magnetic dipole is mu naught over 4 pi times 3 n hat magnetic moment dotted into n hat minus m vector all divided by the distance cubed. It falls off like 1 over distance cubed. In fact, that's not the whole story. That's everything we've derived so far. But it turns out that there is another term. We will derive it later. But let me go ahead and write it now so you won't have an incomplete formula in your notes. The term we'll derive later is 8 pi over 3. And we had an analog of this term for an electric dipole with a Dirac delta function. This is like super important for hyperfine physics. And like I said, we'll derive this quite important term later. Right, if you look at elementary particles in nature, electron, it's got a spin, it's got a magnetic dipole moment. Proton has a magnetic dipole moment. Neutrons have an electric dipole, a magnetic dipole moment. All these particles have magnetic dipole moments. And they cause tiny, tiny interactions and shifts of energy levels in atoms and nuclei. And it's hard to have more fun than that. Okay, so we did this kind of very simple situation for a magnetic dipole. We took a current loop and we, by brute force, calculated its vector potential and magnetic induction and found that a magnetic loop like that, far away from it, it can be characterized by its magnetic dipole moment. But now, we're going to do the hard work of generalizing all that. And we're going to do a multiple expansion of the field produced by currents in magnetostatics. This will involve some pretty nasty vector calculus. Some of the scariest derivations in Jackson are in this chapter. Okay, but we can do that. Multiple expansion. So with electrostatics, it wasn't that hard to write a dipole, a quadrupole, yes, an octopole, a hexadecapole. But this is so nasty with B fields and the way they twist and stuff, we're just going to do the dipole. By far the most important. But we'll do it in complete generality. I don't think so. It doesn't ring a bell, but
is there a good resource that you would recommend for finding that?
Don't believe so. Maybe Sobelman's book on atomic physics. It has a kind of a general multiple expansion of the electromagnetic field, not just in magnetostatics, but in general time-dependent fields, which is useful if you have to do a magnetic quadrupole transition one day. It's probably also in the old Blatt and Weisskopf nuclear physics, nuclear theory book. I seem to recall seeing it there. I like your hunger. I'll be interested to see if you still have that hunger after we finish with the dipole. Okay, so I'm going to assume some stuff, like we did also for the case of the electric field, that all the currents we care about are localized. And so we can use the expansion of 1 over the distance between an observation point and a source current for r much greater than r prime. This will go to 1 over distance to leading order, 1 over r, but with a correction that's probably going to be important, at least the next order correction, x prime dot the vector x over the magnitude of x cubed. So that falls off like 1 over distance squared. There is, of course, more terms, the next of which would fall off like r to the minus 3. If you need to do some estimates of whether or not you can neglect that term. And you can just do the usual Taylor expansion, right? Psi of, for any scalar function, psi of x plus h. You may not, if you're like I was in my first year of graduate school, you might not be that familiar on a daily basis with multi-dimensional Taylor series, but the first two terms can be written in this simple form, h dotted into the gradient. So let's look at one Cartesian component of the vector potential, for starters. So AI of X is mu naught over 4 pi. And plugging that in our general integral of J of X prime d cubed X prime over the distance. Plugging in our expansion, we'll get 1 over the distance to the observation point for an observation point far away from the currents. The volume integral of Ji of x prime d cubed x prime. And the next term is x over the distance cubed dotted into the volume integral of Ji of x prime times x prime d cubed x prime. Right, the dot product means the dot with this x prime, of course, through going through the scalar function, which is just the one component. Any one component of a vector function you can think of as itself is a scalar function, right? It has no unit vector attached to it. Okay, so those are the terms we're going to keep, the leading order terms. Next, I'm going to invoke some identities that are going to seem like they came out of nowhere. And the reason I'm using them is because they are the ones that work. But if you didn't know that in advance, you would start trying random, all the vector identities you could think of. And you'd eventually hit the one that works. That's the annoying thing about all these identities that have to be invoked. Okay, so here's the identity I'm going to use. The volume integral of Ji of x prime d cubed x prime can be written, this will amaze you. I could write that as the volume integral of the primed gradient of the scalar function xi prime dotted into j of x prime. It seems like a really silly way to write that, but you can probably see that that's pretty clearly true. The gradient prime of xi prime is going to be the unit vector xi hat. Yeah.
Is the left side supposed to have x prime?
Sorry?
Like the x prime
vector. So you're talking about this term?
Yeah.
Oh, right. I'm working on this term. We'll get to that other term later. Yeah, good question. Okay, so now in this form, we can invoke the type of identity we've used previously in the course, where we rewrite this as a divergence minus another term. Okay, so we can write this as the volume integral of del prime dotted into the quantity xi prime j of x prime minus xi prime del prime dotted into j of x prime d cubed x prime. Okay, and now this term is zero in magnetostatics, right? Del dot j is zero because d rho dt is zero. And this integral, we can do the divergence theorem, xi prime j of x prime dot dA prime. And that goes to zero because the surface S we've taken outside of all the currents. We went to large distance. Okay. So this first term that would look like 1 over distance, right? For electrostatics, we would have called a similar term the monopole moment of the electric charge. Here we've proven that in magnetostatics, it's always zero. So there is no monopole term ever in magnetostatics. Huge difference from electrostatics. You never get a 1 over distance magnetic field. And that is also related to the absence in nature and in Maxwell equations of magnetic monopoles. There are no magnetic monopoles. Del dot B is always zero. If there are magnetic monopoles, that statement will have to be revised, changed, altered, modified, canceled. Cancel culture. Okay, this next term is really scary. This will require 2 pages of algebra, so I think I'll start it next time. Don't have time to get very far with it today. You can read ahead, see all the methods I'm using, and you might review, if you haven't looked recently, at your Levi Civita symbols and those identities. You need to know those. Is there anyone here who has never heard of a Levi Civita symbol? Okay, look it up on Wikipedia and we'll be using them next time. See you. Let's see if I can levitate one more time. Can he do it? It's not so easy. I have to pull it up to this minimum. It's trying to go. It's really bouncing around, too much kinetic energy. Anyway, you can try if you want. I have a few minutes before I have to leave. Yeah.